Tonight on PBS News Weekend, Israel's offensive turns to southern Gaza, raising the death toll as hopes for a renewed ceasefire dwindle. Then what a new methane deal reached at the UN's climate summit today means for the future of climate change. And how doctors are navigating the new abortion landscape almost a year and a half after the Supreme Court dismantled Roe versus Wade.
If it becomes clear that they're leaning towards a termination, I have to say, unfortunately, this is illegal in the state of Wisconsin. And it feels like I'm abandoning my patients in saying that.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight, hopes for another pause in the fighting in Gaza anytime soon have dimmed considerably. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered his negotiators home from Qatar, saying the talks there had hit a dead end. Since fighting resumed, at least 200 Palestinians have been killed, bringing the death toll since October 7th to more than 15,200, those numbers from the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. Meanwhile, the focus of Israel's renewed aerial bombardment of Gaza has shifted from the north.
In the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, the streets are engulfed in smoke. The Israeli military has dropped leaflets urging residents of the city and the surrounding area to evacuate further south. But beleaguered Gazans say there is nowhere to go. They seek refuge wherever they can find it, like this makeshift camp outside Al Nasser Hospital.
We fled the north before coming here. We went to various places. There's no safe place in Gaza.
Our houses are gone. Our property is gone. Our money is gone. Some died, some handicapped in the hospital. What is left to cry for? And then they tell us we will get aid. Where is it?
As the wounded fill Al Nasser Hospital, today that aid, 50 trucks full according to the Palestine Red Crescent Society, entered through the Rafah crossing along the Egyptian border, the first relief since the ceasefire ended Friday. Yesterday, Israel had blocked aid from getting into Gaza. Since the fighting resumed, the Israeli Defense Forces says it has struck more than 400 Hamas targets across Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the fighting would not stop until Israel meets its objectives.
We will continue the war until we achieve all its goals, and it's impossible to achieve those goals without the ground operation. The ground operation was necessary to bring the results until now, and it is necessary to bring the results moving forward.
With hopes of a renewed ceasefire dissipating, Vice President Kamala Harris spoke with reporters in Dubai, laying out the Biden administration's vision for peace.
Five principles guide our approach for post-conflict Gaza. No forcible displacement, no reoccupation, no siege or blockade, no reduction in territory, and no use of Gaza as a platform for terrorism. We want to see a unified Gaza and West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. And Palestinian voices and aspirations must be at the center of this work.
Mark Regev, a top advisor to Netanyahu, says Israel wants a security buffer zone inside Gaza to further separate it from Israel to ensure there will never be a repeat of the October 7th slaughter.
You won't have a situation in the future where you can have Hamas terrorists on the border, directly on the border, positioned just to cross over and kill our people again. There will have to be security arrangements on the ground to prevent that from happening.
In Tel Aviv and across Israel, thousands rallied, demanding the release of the 136 hostages Israel says are still being held by Hamas. But Hamas leaders told Al Jazeera today that there would be no more hostages exchanged with Israel until the war is over.
At the United Nations COP28 climate conference in Dubai, Vice President Harris pledged $3 billion toward a global fund to help poorer nations adapt to climate change. The United States also committed to doubling energy efficiency and tripling the use of renewable energy by 2030. Harris said the time for action is now.
The urgency of this moment is clear. The clock is no longer just ticking, it is banging. and we must make up for lost time. And we must treat the climate crisis as the existential threat that it truly is.
Officials also announced a major new initiative aimed at getting methane emissions to near zero by 2030. In Atlanta, a protester is in critical condition tonight after setting themselves on fire outside the Israeli consulate. A security guard who tried to intervene was also burned. Police said they found a Palestinian flag at the scene and called it an act of extreme political protest. And a Bavarian blizzard has dropped record snow amounts on much of Germany, Austria, the Czech Republic, and Switzerland. The storm knocked out power to thousands and stalled travel across the region, grounding flights, burying highways, and forcing mass transit to close. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, a new pledge to reduce methane emissions around the world, and how abortion restrictions are affecting the care doctors can give patients in Wisconsin.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
At the COP28 summit in Dubai today, 50 oil and gas companies representing about 40% of global production pledged to reduce methane emissions to near zero by 2030. Methane's a byproduct of oil and gas production that can trap 80 times as much heat as carbon dioxide in the short term. The companies, including industry giants like ExxonMobil, Shell, and BP, say they'll achieve this by plugging leaks at their facilities and ending the practice of burning off excess gas with flares. At the same time, the Biden administration announced new rules to enforce major elements of that agreement in this country. Earlier, I spoke with Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, who was at COP28. I asked him what makes this deal so important.
John, I've been at this for a long time, and in my 30-plus years of doing this work, I don't think we've ever had as good a day for the climate as we had today. First, we had the U.S. EPA announcing the strongest methane rules for the oil and gas sector on the planet. Second, we had 50 companies representing 40% of global oil production pledging to virtually eliminate their methane pollution. And then third, we saw an announcement from the U.S. and China that they've agreed to incorporate methane in the future into their pledges internationally. And methane, John, is 80 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, pound for pound, in those first 20 years. And so reductions now that will happen as a result of these three actions mean that storms will be less ferocious, temperatures will be lower than they would otherwise be over the next 10 years, thanks to the actions that were pledged today.
And is this a long-term solution to the problem, or is this a sort of short-term quick fix?
Well, we have to both do methane to reduce temperatures in the short term, and we cannot stop working. In fact, we have to accelerate our work on eliminating carbon dioxide. The oil and gas industry took this one step, but they have to do a lot more than this. We have to move away from reliance or dependency on fossil fuels as quickly as we can. But while we're still using them, we have to eliminate this very powerful greenhouse gas, methane.
This agreement is voluntary. The oil companies have to do what they promise to do. And a lot of environmental groups don't like that. They say there's no accountability mechanism or guarantee the companies will follow through. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's good to be skeptical of pledges at the COP. A lot of pledges that have been made at this Conference of the Parties year after year aren't delivered on. In this particular pledge, we structured it to have accountability built in. So the oil and gas companies are agreeing to report their emissions by monitoring them and then sending them to an international independent third party. In addition to that, the Bloomberg Philanthropies today announced a major $25 million gift to not only the Environmental Defense Fund, but it will stand up an accountability partnership that will make data transparent. And so we'll be able to see exactly who is meeting this pledge and who's not.
But there's really no teeth in that. They sort of, you're relying on public shaming to just sort of publicize that they're missing their goals?
It turns out that oil companies, in order to stay in business like other businesses, need public support, a license to operate. But there is some more teeth than that. Just a couple of weeks ago, the European Union passed new methane regulations that anticipate within a few years, they will put in place import standards that require companies to meet this sort of cleanup. And the sort of cleanup we're talking about, John, is not incremental. The average company that has signed up will have to reduce their methane pollution by 80 to 90%, and not by some faraway date of 2050, but by 2030. They'll be giving these measurements to an independent international third party, and MethaneSat, an environmental defense fund project, that will be able to look at 80% of the oil and gas infrastructure worldwide multiple times a week. And that's how we will know whether companies are meeting the standards. And then the purchasers like the European Union and maybe a few years later Japan will be able to enforce that.
Today, of course, the Biden administration, the EPA, also announced new rules on methane. How do these two work together?
Well, the Biden administration rules are the strongest on the planet. That will not only help clean up the United States, but here at the COP, I've been meeting with oil companies from developing nations, and most of the questions they've asked me have been, what's that EPA regulation coming out? What are the monitoring requirements in it? So because the United States is the biggest oil and gas producer in the world, other countries and companies look to our regulation to kind of set the bar for their practices. It's plugging leaks. It's when the compressor seals wear out and the compressor is leaking methane, you'll have to replace them periodically. You'll have to regularly go look for and fix leaks. This isn't rocket science. This is something the oil company should already be doing. But an 80, 90% reduction, that's a very big deal.
Is the agreement to reach the lower levels, to essentially bring it to near zero by 2030, or does the agreement also do the specific things of plugging methane leaks and stopping venting?
The agreement is performance-oriented. So we know now that these companies are leaking 2 or sometimes 3% of the methane they take out of the ground, natural gas is methane, leaking 2 or 3%. And the agreement requires near zero defined as 0.2%. So going from 2 to 0.2, that's where you get that 80 to 90% reduction. The reductions in this pollutant mean we'll actually reduce pollution in the next 10 years, that we'll be able to feel that benefit. We'll be able to reduce temperatures from what we would otherwise experience.
Do you think this year's summit will be the time that they finally address fossil fuels and deal with fossil fuels? Either an agreement to reduce them or an agreement to eventually eliminate their use?
Well, I don't know that that will happen. This year, there's been an agreement by many countries, over 100 countries, to triple the construction of renewable energy and to double energy efficiency by 2030. So we need that those things in order to be able to rapidly get away from fossil fuel. And but I don't know that the language of do we phase it out or do we get out of it completely by when will be agreed on. I don't think that's likely.
Fred Krupp of the Environmental Defense Fund at the COP28 summit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
While the number of legal abortions has gone up nationwide since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, a recent report from a group that supports reproductive rights says there have been sharp declines in states that impose new restrictions on abortion access. One of those states, Wisconsin, saw around 7,000 fewer abortions in the year following the court's decision than the state's annual average. Marissa Wojcik of PBS Wisconsin spoke with doctors there about the effect on their work and on their patients.
When I got the results, I knew what I wanted to do. It was really hard emotionally. I was devastated. I wanted that baby.
Jen Volstead is a former labor and delivery nurse in Milwaukee. At 12 weeks pregnant, Volstead was told something wasn't right. At 19 weeks pregnant, she found out she and her unborn child were at risk.
I knew that if I carried that pregnancy to term, I was putting my own health at risk. And I also knew that my baby, if she survived to term, would only suffer.
Jen Volstead made her decision while abortion was still legal. The cascade of events following the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling overturning the constitutional right to an abortion hit states like Wisconsin the hardest, creating a near-total abortion ban in the state 1 year ago.
We have yet to see what systemic consequences this law will have.
Healthcare providers like Christopher Ford, a Milwaukee-based emergency medicine physician, found themselves in legal limbo when the default legal standing reverted back to a law from 1849. It says destroying the life of an unborn child is a felony, except to save the life of the mother.
We are in a situation where that interpretation of a law from 1849 is really a gray area.
We didn't even know that germs caused disease in 1849.
Before Roe v. Wade was overturned, Dr. Kristen Lyerly, an OBGYN from Green Bay, counseled patients at one of the few Planned Parenthood clinics in Wisconsin that provided abortions. Following the decision, she, Dr. Ford, and Dr. Jen Jury McIntosh, a maternal fetal medicine physician in Milwaukee, joined a lawsuit challenging the 1849 law.
Now we're operating in this narrow channel of providing the best care, not committing malpractice, and being careful not to break a law. These pregnant people either have high-risk conditions themselves, so medical complications, but on the flip side, we also take care of fetuses, so get the most family-centered outcome that we can.
Prior to the Supreme Court's ruling, Wisconsin patients and physicians had more options when it came to making decisions about reproductive health care.
We would have conversations about what all their options were. We would talk about everything. Sometimes we would connect them with prenatal care. Sometimes we would connect them with adoption services. Sometimes they would go home and think about it, and they just wouldn't return for that second visit. But often they did.
Now these doctors are managing a much different reality.
If it becomes clear that they're leaning towards a termination, I have to say, unfortunately, this is illegal in the state of Wisconsin. And if this is what you choose to pursue, then we'll have to give you information on how to pursue this out of state. And it feels like I'm abandoning my patients in saying that.
Some physicians, like Dr. Lyerly, left Wisconsin so they can continue to provide reproductive care without fear of prosecution.
I have the joy of working in rural Minnesota and northern Arizona on the Navajo Reservation. So in a way, it's very satisfying. But the truth is, I want to be home.
For those who stayed, they must now navigate a law that many doctors feel is unclear.
It's intrinsically vague, which then causes physicians to potentially second guess, like, is this risky enough? Because everyone who practices medicine knows that it can be very gray for a while and then become very black and white. The longer you wait to intervene, the worse the outcomes are in general.
We've heard reports, you know, in other states that have very strict abortion bans like we do here in Wisconsin, in which, you know, we've had patients that have been told to wait in the car until they become even more unstable in order to present to the emergency department so at that point in time they can do something about it. Now, of course, that's an egregious example, and that's something that we don't aspire to. However, that is someone's interpretation of the law.
There was a time when I was in Minnesota where someone presented, she was bleeding. She was 21 weeks pregnant with a desired pregnancy, but she was bleeding so much that she had to go to the operating room right away. And I had to perform an abortion. And I couldn't help but to think to myself, if this was happening to me in Wisconsin, I would be terrified about what the next steps would be, about what the implications for my future, my career would be.
Physicians worry. Not only about the consequences today, but those yet to come.
What I'm seeing over and over and over again is this getting worse over time. And a lot of that has to do with the access of healthcare, with the access of, you know, care to obstetrics and gynecology. And a lot of the voices that are at the table right now don't see these patients and they don't have any medical background, but they're making these decisions.
I just want to do my job. So the fact that politics are trying to be present in my exam room, present in the back of my mind as I'm looking at a patient and talking to that patient and their family, that it's impacting that at all feels crazy to me. Because really, we should just be providing the best evidence-based medical care that we can that's right for that patient and right for their family.
And for Jen Volstead, she hopes in the future, Wisconsinites will be able to navigate these difficult decisions without the barriers in place today.
Now, when I look back, I feel so recovered and healed. I also wouldn't have my son if I didn't have this abortion because of the timing, if I had to carry to term. Julian, he just turned 6, and he is one of the most joyful and curious people I've ever met. The more we try to focus on, is that right or wrong, or is that okay, the more we're focused on making choices for other people when we're not involved in their healthcare and we're not medical professionals.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Marissa Wojcik in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Now online, CDC data shows life expectancy went up for the first time since the pandemic, but is still lagging where it was before COVID. You can find all that and more on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.